A David and Goliath battle for press freedom and against media persecution is a central theme of a powerful and arresting documentary by my next guest. In A Thousand Cuts, Ramona Diaz follows the rise of Filipino strongman Rodrigo Duterte and the mostly female journalists who brave his intimidation. In particular, there's Maria Ressa, who founded the Rappler News website, which has been at the forefront of fighting propaganda spread through social media. The documentary also spends time with pro-Duterte figures, including pop dancer and social media star Mocha Yusun, and Ronald De La Rosa, the Corrections Bureau director, who's proud to say he'd kill for Duterte in his brutal drug war. A Thousand Cuts screens on the opening night film of the online documentary Edge International Film Festival 2020. We say hello to Ramona, who's in Maryland, USA. Hi, Ramona.
Hi. Good morning or good evening.
The timelines. Freedom of the press is enshrined in the Philippines constitution, but so many journalists are under siege there. Is this what made you want to focus on this story, this contradiction?
Yes, and also in the rise of Duterte, right? When President Duterte became a president and the drug war started. I live in the U.S. and my Facebook feed started being populated by all these horrific photographs of the drug war. So that was the impetus for my wanting to make a film about President Duterte and in the Philippines right now. And then one thing led me to another. My research led me to Maria, and she's the loudest voice, you know, speaking out against Duterte in the Philippines right now, because basically there is no, there is an opposition, you know, but they're very, they're silenced. So she's the loudest. And I wanted to, when I met her, it was so obvious that the film had to center around her fight for press freedom.
What makes me curious, you could easily have focused the entire documentary on Maria and her struggle. It's such a big story. But it was clearly important to you that you also introduce us to these pro-Duterte figures that I mentioned before. Mocha Yusun on the social media front, Ronald De La Rosa, the Corrections Bureau. You know, those on the side of this very divisive leader. How on earth did you do it? How did you get your cameras there? How did you get their trust?
You know, you ask. Usually, you know, I've been doing documentaries for a long time, and I've learned that I need to ask. And if you ask, if they like the camera, they will say yes. And if they have something to say, and they feel I'm giving them the space to do it, they will say yes. Like, and I also like including them because there's more to, like, Mocha Yusun, yes, she is. She's known as this dancer who became a politician and supported President Duterte and became a candidate. But she has very real reasons in why she wants to support him, right? Her personal history, how her father died and was assassinated. So I really like looking at the grays and not the black and white. And everyone always has a personal story to tell. I'm not defending Mocha Yusun and fake news and what she puts out there. I'm not. But I'm just trying to see beyond, you know, beyond the headlines.
Well, it makes it much more compelling and interesting when someone like Mocha is seems genuine in her belief that what she is doing is right. She likes the attention, of course she does. But as you say, there are stories behind this. I mean, the obvious thing is you would say to her, why could you defend somebody who takes such a harsh stance against women, says the most extraordinary things about women, and yet there she is. She could be like a trophy, you know. But I don't think she sees it that way.
No, because, you know, like she says in the film, you know, if he was really a misogynist, he would never take me in, right? He would never appoint me because now she's part of the government. He would never support my run for Congress, right? So she's Exhibit A in her book of, you know, proving that Duterte is not misogynistic. But of course, that's a very strange argument to make, because out of his mouth, every time he speaks, he says a lot of really, I mean, he, he calls out women that are sitting in the audience and starts talking to, you know, to starts talking about their looks and how he wants to date them, which is very strange. And he does that constantly. But Mocha really believes in him. And I wanted to get to the core of that belief. What was, why she, you know, the real reason for him, for her believing in him. But I think, I think they, in a way, they don't deserve her loyalty because in the end, they sort of abandoned her and she failed in her bid for Congress.
Yeah, you certainly had some sympathy for her. But as I say, the focus on this is Maria Ressa. Now, what an extraordinary woman this is. And when you contacted her and talked through this proposal, did she, she's got a lot going on, let's be honest, a lot happening. Did she instantly say yes?
No. Yeah, like you said, she has a lot going on and she was constantly being arrested. So there was a lot of journalists around her. You know, she was breaking news. And I don't usually go after breaking news, right? Because it's tough to go after breaking news. I usually stay longer in people's lives. But I realized when I met her that I need to tell her story. And I remember we started really principal photography the day before she got arrested. And when the day she got, I think February 12th, we got it. We arrived in the country. February 13th, she got arrested and she texted me and she said, if you're not doing anything, please come because they're arresting me. And I'm like, okay, we're not doing anything. We can come and I'll follow you to the National Bureau of Investigations where she was detained. And so that was the start of our principal photography. So, of course, it's like catching lightning in a bottle, right? And then she happens to be very very charismatic, and people are drawn to her. So she was really the perfect character to talk about press freedom. And it was life unfolding in front of the lens. So I don't think she understood exactly what I wanted from her, but she knew after a while that it was different because I stayed. I didn't leave, right? She's a journalist herself, right? So she goes into people's lives for a few days and then leaves. But I tend to stay. I tend to stay for months. And then after a while, I think she understood what it was I was trying to do. And I think by default, just because I was there all the time, she said, you know, it was yes.
That arresting sequence, though, Ramona, is so compelling. I mean, she's so calm. I mean, she's been arrested before. You know, this is not the first time she'd gone through it. And she just had she was kind of almost smiling at you, you know, knowingly through the camera. Here we go. She addresses the media press gang that are there to talk to. She is calm. She explains exactly her situation. And then away she goes. And these are serious charges that she's facing. Yep. And as I say, she's charismatic. But it's that calmness that got me, I think.
Yeah, it got me too, you know, and I was thrown by her her smile, right? Her constant optimism. It was irrepressible. And that's what caught me by surprise. And I did ask her, I'm like, are you really, you know, do you always see the, you know, silver lining? And she goes, I have to, because otherwise it's whatever, 63 years in prison. And she goes, and if I'm not, then they win, right? If she is not optimistic, she feels like they win. So she hangs on to that, but it comes more naturally to her. Because I think she's also been a, you know, a war journalist, right? So she plans how she is gonna how she's gonna react, right? It's this very, it's very intentional, and the fact that she sticks to it is really impressive. But she is that, she is optimistic, and that was the one big surprise. She never really lost her cool throughout, you know, all the arrests and harassment and the trolling too. I think the trolling is even worse than the arrests. Of course, the arrests are so bad, but the trolling, it's constant and personal and sexualized. And they call her every animal in the book. It's horrific. And yet she stays really, I don't know, she's very calm through all of that.
Let's talk about her life story, because one of the other intriguing things about Maria Ressa is that she has chosen the Philippines. She's not born there. She doesn't have that responsibility that you have to your home country often. She chose the Philippines quite deliberately, but she was born in Manila.
She was born in Manila, but she left when she was 10, right? And then came of age really in the U.S. So she's dual. She's both Filipino and American. She holds two passports. And actually, she went to the Philippines on a Fulbright, thinking she was only going to stay a year, and was so drawn to the country because she arrived there right after the Marcos years, after long years of dictatorship, and the country was remaking itself. They were building institutions, and that's what she really loved about it. And that's why she stayed. But now it's sort of it's come full circle, right, with Duterte. I mean, you know, it's like it's martial. It feels like martial all over again. And but yet she chooses to stay because now she has a fight. Yeah, it's commendable. Everyone thinks that she lives now in the U.S. But and every time I was with her in a lot of the conferences all over the world, and people would tell her, why do you go back? She goes, of course I have to go back. You know, she goes, first of all, I have to bear witness to what's happening to me. It's got to be on the record. And she goes, she's never thought of not going back. To her, it's like, no, it's a fight. It's like the torch was passed to her and she has to see it through.
You have a scene of her looking through a photo album, photographs and some documents as well. And it's quite telling. She, as you say, she's had a very successful career. And again, she looks so young and so optimistic, and she didn't change very much actually in many ways, you know. But this long dedication both to the Philippines and to journalism.
Yes, she always says journalism has been the longest relationship in her life. Because before Rappler, before she founded her own company, she was really the face of CNN in Southeast Asia and the region. Actually, I met her when she was the CNN Manila and Jakarta bureau chief. And then after CNN, she headed the biggest broadcasting corporation in the Philippines, ABS-CBN, which has since been shut down by Duterte. That happened very recently. But so she's had many lives before Rappler. And I think to her, Rappler was, she embraces tech. She embraces new tech and journalism, because she doesn't think journalism can exist these days without embracing tech. So that's her thing, and that's what Rappler is all about, right? That's what Rappler is trying to prove, that you have to embrace tech, and that's why she embraced Facebook before. You know, she says she's frenemies with Facebook. Because she has to call them, you know, she has to call them to account, especially now, especially, you know, with Trump trying to silence Twitter. And she's right. I think she's at the forefront of having those conversations.
It's nearly a decade, I think, since she co-founded Rappler with this online news site. She hired a big staff of 20-ish digital natives. Rappler has got under Duterte's skin, hasn't it?
Yes, because they talk about the drug war, right? I think what first got them into trouble was they questioned the drug war. They questioned the numbers and they questioned impunity, right? And they were the first ones to do it. And so, people like Mocha Uson started seeding this idea that Rappler was foreign owned. And before you knew it, Duterte was saying that Rappler was foreign owned, and he's tried to close them down, but they fought it in court, and that's why they're still alive. But they keep doing, you know, they keep calling him. They want him to account for everything he's done. So they get under his skin. That's for sure.
Her style is not in an interview, is again with that smile, isn't it? She is unfailingly polite in one of the interviews that you show with Duterte. He's saying really shocking things about this hunt for the drug dealers and how they're to be dealt with. But there she is, you know, sort of kind of ray of polite sunshine.
Yes, but what she's saying too is like, but Mr. President, you've broken the law. You said you killed a year ago. You told me you killed, right? But she's saying it with a smile, which is really like, I think it throws people. But that's her way. I think that's also very, it's also very non-confrontational, which is very Filipino. So even if she was born in, even if she was raised in the States, there's something very Filipino about her, right? It's very non-confrontational with a smile, but yet she's accusing him of having committed murder because that's what he says he's done, right? He stole her. Yeah, I committed murder just months ago. And she calls him on it a year later. As president now, you're supposed to defend the Constitution, but you've broken the law yourself. How do you reconcile that?
Is this
and I think he's...
You go.
No, I think she's the only one who's really asked him that question, right? Because no one really believed that he would... you know, he has this rhetoric of violence that is really shocking, but no one has really asked him about it. I think it was Maria, the very first one who asked him. When he first became president,
why is that? Is it fear? Because he's obviously incredibly powerful, and this killing of drug addicts, of drug dealers, of journalists, of dissidents is now part of his culture. So are the hard questions not being asked because of fear by other journalists?
Yeah, or you know, I think they didn't quite believe it. They thought it was just, you know, bluster. But of course, what happened, he was the mayor of Davao, which is a town in the south. He cleaned up Davao. And so, you know, and so he's, you know, it was just like, you know, that's how he speaks. It's really just bluster. There's no real truth to it. But then the drug war happened, right? And the numbers kept rising. So obviously you had to ask him. Obviously you come around to ask him about the murders. Because he did, you know, he did run his campaign, ran on the promise of a drug war, that he was going to get every drug, whatever, drug dealer, drug user, drug pusher. And no one quite, they're like, okay, no one quite believed it, but it happened. It happened shortly after he became president and the numbers kept rising. And then, of course, he deals with fear, right? That's how he knows. That's what he says. He thinks fear is important. It's an important aspect of leadership.
Is he winning the drug war, do you think?
No, I don't think so. Because he hasn't really gotten the drug lords, right? He's gotten the petty drug users and drug pushers, but he hasn't gotten the machinery. And that's really the... that's really what the opposition is saying. It's like, of course, the numbers are rising. They're horrific, but you haven't gotten the machinery because the drug problem is still as bad in the Philippines. But it was never, you see, the drug problem was not, the drugs were not a concern of the Philippines, of the Filipinos during the 2016 campaign. But because that was what he ran on, and they were so good on social media about making drugs the problem, that at the end, when he won, like drugs were like a main concern of the Filipinos, when it was never really a concern before the 2016 campaign, before the 2016 election. It was jobs, right? Job security. And after the campaign, it was drugs. That, you know, they did a really good social media campaign. He was the very first candidate to really run a solid campaign on social media. Duterte was. He embraced social media.
Given the drug war can also be seen as a de facto war on the poor, what's his popularity like?
His popularity, the last time I looked, was like, it's still high. It's like in the 70s.
How can it be? Are his policies popular?
Because it's on the poor, right? The middle class and the elite, they're not touched, right? And also, if you ask Maria, okay, this is a conversation Maria and I always have, why? She thinks it's because it's still fake news, right? It's still... It's still social media. is still running on social media, like sort of seeding social media with all the good policies that are not working. And there are surveys, but do you really believe the survey? The survey says 73%, but those surveys are conducted in the privacy of homes, right? And since there's so much fear, are you going to really say that you're not for Duterte, right? So there's that. So it depends on who. Some believe the survey, some don't believe the survey. And also, you know, COVID-19, it's a game changer now because everyone is in lockdown and there is no testing. And so I think his popularity is slipping because of COVID, not because of the drug war, because of the pandemic.
I'm talking to Director Ramona Diaz of 1,000 Cuts. We learned from your documentary, Ramona, that most people in the Philippines are on Facebook and that Cambridge Analytica tried out its methods in the Philippines first before famously coming adrift in the US. And I think Maria Ressa worked out that 26 fake accounts can influence up to 3 million, which is phenomenal, isn't it? How do you fight that? And how did the Philippines come to be the kind of guinea pig?
I think because we've always been on social. I think because we also speak English, you know. A lot of the business is conducted in English. Schools are in English. Although the national language is Tagalog, everyone speaks English. I think that's the main reason why. And because we adapted so early, I remember texting was a thing before it ever was a thing in the U.S. I remember returning to Manila in the early aughts, I think early 2000s or 1999, I think it was. Texting was already a thing. I think texting and being on social is very... It suits the national character because, again, we're non-confrontational, right? And social media sort of absolves you of the face-to-face confrontation. You don't have to. Texting does that as well. So it's easier to say no or not answer at all. So I think it suits the national character. And also, that's my take. No one has really studied this, but I think that's why I think social media is so interesting. It surprised me a lot of people have this really fancy phones and they live, even if they live in like the poorest neighborhoods, they're on social media.
We talked about Moke Yusin before and these pro-Duterte figures that you speak to. We must spend a bit of time talking about Ronald De La Rosa, the police chief, corrections bureau director, charismatic in his own way, would you say?
Absolutely. And that's why I wanted to film him, because I think he's a jester. He's this sort of clownish figure, but he's also very scary, right? Because he was the implementer of the drug war. Under him, he was the head of the Philippine National Police. He was the first implementer of the drug war, and the numbers really rose under him. And when he campaigns, there's a scene in the film, he campaigns for the drug war. That was his only thing. He just wanted to continue the drug war, and that's why he wanted to run for to become senator. And then he jokes with the audience, like, if you don't clap, then you're a drug addict, right? So he gives them entertainment on the one hand, and the other, he's like threatens them. And then he's sort of this jester figure because he dances, he sings, he's all that. But underneath, he's very scary. So I think he's a very interesting character in that way, because I think he's scarier that way because he gives you this kind of entertaining figure and kind of foolish figure, but underneath scary because he kills, he doesn't, and like he says, he will kill for the president, and he has, right, with the drug war.
Over Duterte's, I think now 3 years in power, press freedom has declined severely. I think it's ranked something like Philippines 134 out of 178 countries, and it's in the Press Freedom Index from Reporters Without Borders. As a filmmaker trying to shine a light on this, have you been subject to intimidation?
No, not yet. I tried to make this film really under the radar. It's only now that we are rolling out the film that I'm getting the trolls and the intimidation. They've finally caught up with us. And we're still able to block them and stop the trolling because it's not exponential yet because we're only starting to roll it out. But we were very aware that we couldn't be we couldn't be very high profile making this film because then we would be trolled just like Maria. But we're ready for it, you know. We've been ready for it. We've sort of we have different scenarios on how to handle it, especially if it becomes exponential.
This is, I think, now the sixth documentary that you've made dealing with the Philippines, starting in 1996 through to now. What are your thoughts about the future of your homeland?
I don't know, it's grim, right? I mean, it's so the Marcos dictatorship ended in 86. We're now 2020, right? It's only what, less than 50 years, right? We're back to a strong man like Duterte. So and Duterte, who he's put the whole country in lockdown and he shut down the biggest media broadcasting corporation in the country. And 80% of the population get their news and entertainment from from ABS-CBN, which is he's shut it down because he said the franchise expired. But then it's a long story. The franchise did expire, but it was being heard in Congress, right? There were hearings in Congress over this franchise. So really, it was illegal to shut them down, but he shut them down. And everyone is in lockdown, so no one can protest, right? It's really the perfect time to start shutting down stuff. So people are saying it feels like martial law without him ever having to declare martial law. And everything he does, which is interesting, everything he does is under this sort of veil of legality. Even with Maria, right? It's like it's all these legal cases. I don't think he's ever going to really take her in prisoner without going through the process. So under the guise of legality, he's doing that. But and it's scarier. He doesn't have to declare martial law. There's curfew. There are checkpoints. They're in lockdown. ABS is dark. So I fear. I'm really sad, actually, for the country.
Rowena Diaz, thank you so much. A Thousand Cuts is showing as part of the Dock Edge Online Film Festival 2020, which is screening virtually nationwide from Friday the 12th of June.